Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
Well, Dave Heron is the originator of the 10-Dex statistical analysis. He has been covering the NBA in some form or another since he was a child, basically. His new book is called 75, and he joins us on this show to discuss it. Welcome, Dave.
Well, thank you, Michael. I appreciate the opportunity.
Now, basically, at the beginning of this book, you say, maybe I should have called it 74 because I really didn't catch the first season of the NBA. But I mean, can you talk about kind of like your early years as a basketball fan before you got into doing statistics? Because
that refers to my age. I was 9 years old when the NBA started. My dad, I think when I was 10, he started getting me tickets. He was a sports writer for one of the sports editors for the New York Times. And he got me all kinds of stuff from Madison Square Garden, the Yankees, you know, unbelievably great stuff. So by the time I was 10, I did get a chance to watch some games in Madison Square Garden. I'm not sure about when I was 9, but I do know that at that time I was listening on the radio. So I did have touch with the NBA.
Right. So it's a league you've been following since its inception. But that doesn't necessarily, you know, end up being a lifetime of, you know, crunching numbers for that sport. Can we talk about kind of like, did you have a natural affinity for math and statistical analysis even before you started kind of crunching numbers in college?
Yeah, actually I did. My aptitude in math was very high. I didn't do too well on the theoretical stuff that you couldn't put your fingers on, like calculus. But as far as the logical mathematical stuff, I did have that aptitude from the time when I was a child. And then when I got to college, I was at a basketball game involving the University of Delaware team. I was University of Delaware. And I had joined newspaper. It was the Review, was the university newspaper. And they assigned me to go to this game. And at the game, I'm looking and I'm saying, and this guy who's leading the team and scoring and getting honors this and honor that, I don't think he's very good. He was just, every time he got the ball, he would shoot, and he missed most of the time. And there was this other guy who worked really hard. He got a lot of rebounds, worked on defense, passed the ball well. So I said, I'm going to do some stats, and I did. Plus one for points, plus one for rebounds, plus for one for each assist, minus one for each missed shot. And lo and behold, it came out that the guy who, I don't think he was even a double figure scorer. He probably got about half as many points as the other guy. And he was the better player. And that was really, even though it was only four or five different categories, it was the beginning of 10-Dex. 10-Dex was next with 10. And ultimately it got to be 15 because you had to make a whole bunch of divisors to make it work. And I learned them along the way. They didn't all come at once. So originally it was just 10 days.
Right. Now you're assigned to cover this game for the college paper. Like I imagine it's, you know, you're writing like, you know, 500, 600 words, just like a recap, right? Like you're not necessarily sent there to cover like the statistics or an analysis of like one of the players in the game. This is something that just kind of caught your attention.
Yeah. And I wrote it. I did write it up instead of doing the game story. I did write it up. I tried not to be embarrassing to the player who was overrated, but the theory came clear through the article that I wrote that it's not necessarily just scoring. It isn't. It definitely not just scoring. In fact, with some guy like Dennis Rodman, who was a legitimate Hall of Famer, who couldn't score at all. You know, Bill Russell could hardly score at all. He was a very weak offensive player. But there are so many other things involved that these two guys were two of the greatest players in league history. And this was the beginning of my ability to reason that through was that first game. And then it wound up being the columnist for the Wilmington Morning News wrote something, but he wrote a column about it. And from there on, it just went. It just took off. And it made a great leap during the 80s when I got to do a column with the Sporting News. So then it became nationally noticed for the first time. That was, I think it was the mid 80s, about 20 years later. Well, actually more than 20 years later, more like 25 years later. But along the way, it was progressing because I was, you know, doing these numbers and keeping track of them. So it didn't happen all of a sudden, although it got recognized all of a sudden in the mid 80s.
Now you mentioned, you know, obviously you got to 10, which gave you 10 decks, but then eventually you're up to, you know, 15 different kind of things you're analyzing. Refining your statistical analysis over the years, like, is it, you know, do you run things and think this doesn't add up and I need to kind of factor in new things in order to like make this work out? Like what kind of like process does that entail?
Yeah, I think what you just said is exactly right. I think my mathematical ability was related to logic. And the whole 10-deck system is based upon logic. It's got to make sense, not just to compute, but it has to make sense. And yeah, that's exactly what happened. For instance, in order to get a basic 10-deck rating, you've got to divide by minutes played, because obviously, if all the other stats being equal, a guy who plays a lot more minutes is not going to have as high a rating as a guy who can accomplish the same thing in fewer minutes. So you have to divide by minutes played. And then it went from there. The team game pace, how many ball possessions are involved, the positional standard, because it turns out that you cannot compare shooting guards with centers. The centers have a big advantage because they have close in shots and easy rebounds. The guys on the perimeter have to work for it. And this was in an encyclopedia that came about. It was a 10-deck rating, but it was the one I didn't like. And it was later on. And the encyclopedia did not have Michael Jordan with a single Player of the Year award, because the 10-deck rating, it was using a 10-deck system. It wasn't calling a 10-deck, but I had abandoned that one because it didn't work. And the guy who was using it didn't understand why it didn't work. So he has this thing published in this encyclopedia. And Jordan's all-time, according to the legitimate 10-deck rating, which I call the value rating, which takes into consideration that shooting guards, that's the toughest position to get a rating as in comparison with centers. Jordan was actually the Player of the Year 8 times. But in that encyclopedia, not taking into consideration that shooting guard is a much tougher position than center, it was zero. So here is all these Jordan fanatics reading that their great superstar hero was not the Player of the Year a single time. And I have to believe that that was one of the reasons why that encyclopedia was not very popular.
It's like that's one of those situations where the refinement, you say you look at something and it doesn't add up, and then you go back and try to figure out why and then try to isolate the problem. It sounds like you at least have a willingness to reconsider your own statistics and your own kind of darlings and maybe kill a few of them if they're not coming out the right way.
To this day, I still make adjustments where they are needed. And of course, that was a very needful one there to do a positional standard. Now, the norm for a shooting guard overall is about 450. The overall average per player is about 500. The centers, it comes out to about 575, 585, 590. So you can see it's a lot easier to get a high numerical number if you're a center than a shooting guard. And if that is not taken into consideration, you're going to very much underrate the shooting guard and very much overrate the center. And that's just one of the logical things that just came about. I mean, I saw that there was something very wrong there. And the guy, I'm not going to mention who it was, but the guy who called me and wanted to, because he was a great guy, Bob Bellotti. He called me, he had heard that I did not want to use this rating system anymore. So he called me and said, well, can I use it? I said, Jared, go ahead. I knew it didn't write. It didn't work right. I guess he found out the hard way. I don't know what the repercussions were because I was not involved in the communications, but I'm sure that there were some very unhappy Jordan fans and probably some others too, because Jordan was not the only great two guard. Here's the position being very much underrated simply because the standard, well, the guys playing two guards are the farthest from the basket most of the time. The point guards are more penetrating, and the small forwards occasionally come in to rebounding territory. But the shooting guards, of course, Jordan was different. And at times he played the point guard position because he had the ball a lot. But even so, he was still a shooting guard, and a lot of his defensive assignments put him out on the perimeter. So his overall numbers were not as high as they could have been if he was closer to the basket.
How much of a problem does it present when guys are flex, you know, like someone who plays the 4-5, or like, you know, someone like Jordan, you know, who technically is a two guard, but plays that guard, you know, like when they bounce around like that, do you have to adjust how you compare them to other players at those positions, or like do like a blended average of those positions? Like, how do you kind of figure out those flex players like that?
Well, I would say the key thing there is their defensive assignment. For instance, Magic Johnson played a lot of low post defense because he could not guard the point guard position. The point guard was too quick for him. So they had him down lower where his height was an advantage. But I think getting to your question directly is that the defensive assignment determines where that player is going to be at least half of the time. And if he's defending the shooting guard, he's going to be out on the perimeter at least half the time. Now on offense, you can move guys in and out, and Jordan is going to be moving in and out. And of course, Oscar Robertson was probably the greatest at this. He was moving in and out. Well, these are two big guards. I mean, not only were they 6'5", but they were big, you know, they were strong. In Jeremy Robertson's case, he could do the 40-inch vertical, and so could Jordan. These were great athletes, and that's one of the reasons why they're two of the, according to Tindex, they're two of the four greatest players of all time.
Now, you mentioned, you know, obviously, this is applying logic is the you know, kind of the name of the Tindex system, right? Like, you know, you're applying logic to these situations to evaluate things. However, you kind of come up against the fact that the way that things are calculated some of the times isn't logical, right? Like, you point out that in LA, the Lakers, whoever was doing the compiling statistics for those games, right, whether, you know, it was for the Lakers themselves or whoever their opponent was about 10% higher on crediting steals, right? Like, that there's situations in which the raw numbers are maybe in question. How do you work around that?
I think I was the one who discovered it, and I was able to verify it as fact through research. It wound up being that it was really more than 10% high. The Laker official scorer was more than 10% too high on awarding assists. Now his team, the Lakers, were getting a 5% boost from him. But overall, when you consider it's home and road, you're talking about a 10% difference if everybody did it the same way. So it was actually a 10% difference because it was for only half of the games, but the Lakers overall assists were 5% more. And then you got the fact that they did not have a point guard. So this showed it was more than 10%. I never did get the exact number, but it's somewhere between 10 and 15% because the Lakers did not have a point guard. I mean, they didn't have a Robertson or a Magic Johnson. Jerry West did a lot of the ball handling, but he was not point guard. He was a shooting guard. So really what I had to do was, if I were getting down to the nub of it and comparing so-and-so, let's say we're comparing Robertson and West, and West is getting all these assists. And for a couple of years there, he had more assists than Robertson, which was anybody knew, which was totally ridiculous. But you had, when I'm doing these numbers, I kind of had to figure in the adjustment when it came to the individual comparisons, but I did not change the 10-dex rating. So the ratings for West at that time were inflated, but that was the only team that had inflated ratings. So the rest of them could just look at it and say, well, you know, it's a standoff. But in the case of the Lakers, their numbers were inflated. West especially, his assists were inflated.
Right, and then you've got a guy like Oscar Robertson whose stats were deflated, right? Because as you point out, his you know, passing partner in Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, he wasn't getting credited for a lot of the back to the basket passes, right? Like that, these were just like a black hole in his stats.
Right, but fortunately, these 10-dex system, I noticed very early on in doing it that the players had individual, they had peaks, and the standard or for a great player would be about 10 years. For another player would be less than that. But you could have a prime decade. And in the case of Abdul-Jabbar, it would have been his first 10 years in the league. In the case of Robertson, it was the first 10 years in the league because they came in late. They should have been in the league when they were freshmen in college instead of 4 years later. So they're right in their prime when they came into the league. And when you start making the comparisons, you take this into consideration. It didn't happen that often. And to the Lakers' credit, what they were doing, the whole league should have been doing. Because they were not credited. Robertson's throwing these beautiful lead passes to Abdul-Jabbar within 2 or 3 feet of the basket. But since he's got his back to the basket, they're not being counted as assists. Now, when they played a playoff game in LA, I think it was a playoff game. It was an important game. It was on TV. And Robertson at halftime had 10 assists. Well, his season average was 8. And they said, well, what happened? He said, well, Robertson said literally, if the official score in Milwaukee was counting assists the same way, I would be averaging 15 a game instead of 8. And boy, does that make a big difference in your 10-dex rating? But it was pretty much the same for all of the point guards. So when you were comparing them against each other, with the exception of West, it was no big deal. But in a situation where West is involved or Robertson feeding Chamberlain, but Abdul-Jabbar, who was the only great center that Robertson ever had teamed with, this was an exceptional situation. But you had to take into consideration in the playoffs, that in the 70-71 playoffs, 70-71 or 71-72, and it was one of those 2 years, when Milwaukee won the title with Robertson and Abdul-Jabbar, you had all the numbers in front of you because they keep track of the numbers for the championship series. And I could just sit there and run the numbers and see that even though Abdul-Jabbar was voted the MVP for that playoff series, that Robertson actually wasn't, because he had shut down his man. And that's as important as excelling on offense. I think Abdul-Jabbar averaged 35 points and Robertson 23 or something like that. Robertson had a bunch of rebounds and assists, would have had more assists. But the big difference was that Robertson had really shut down Earl of Pearl Monroe. And that was a big deal. It really was, because Earl of Pearl was hard to shut down.
Right, exactly. Now I want to talk about a couple of stats that you take exception to that are kind of, you know, these aren't 10-dex ones, but ones that, you know, compete with 10-dex in terms of commonly used in the parlance. One is VORP, value over replacement player. And the other is scoring average. We'll start with VORP, that, you know, as you argue in the book, you're not talking about a replacement player. You're talking about the actual person who would replace them, right? Like this fictional imaginary player that they're replacing doesn't take into account someone like a James Harden when he's a sixth man in OKC, that the numbers can get greatly skewed by who actually is taking the court in your stead.
Right. I go by standards for the position for replacements. So it's no advantage or disadvantage to the individual, even though it may not be exactly true for that team. But you're doing player ratings. Your player ratings should not depend upon your reserve. You know, if he's lousy, but that makes you look great. If he's great, like a Havlicek, who's probably better than, well, he was. Havlicek was the second best player on the Celtics in those, or in sometimes he was the best. Sometimes he was better than Russell because he was great at both ends of the floor. Russell was just a great defensive player. But with a guy like a Havlicek coming off the bench, which he did for so many years, I mean, how can you call him an RP, you know? He was really there. He was playing starters minutes, but Auerbach liked the impact that he had when he came off the bench. So that's why he did it that way. But the RP is the replacement player instead of having a standard. So the player being rated, it does not go up or down based upon how good his replacement player is, which that's just logic. I mean, 10x is logic. If it's not logic, it doesn't work. And that was one of the reasons I gave up that one stat, because it didn't work.
Now, the other one, like I said, was scoring average. And you have a whole chapter called, you know, Call Them Shootists, right? You devote a chapter of this book to addressing this. And as you point out, it's one of the simplest formulas in 10x. And that's, you know, two components. Points per shot.
Yeah. And there's only one player. This is the most lopsided thing ever. I mean, I used to think on terms of a guy averaging 1.0 points per shot, because obviously free throws, you're going to be below that. So you have to pull up some real strong field goal percentages on three pointers and two pointers in order to reach that 1 point level. But lo and behold, Steph Curry comes along, and I think his rating, if I remember it right, it was 1.116 points per shot. And the guy who was number two was 1.025 or something like that. So Curry has almost a 10% edge over the number two guy. And when you consider that after that, they're all like, you know, all like bunched together. Curry is just way, way better than anybody else in that particular category. Now, not in every other category, but that particular category, Curry is by far the number one. There's no argument. I mean, he was the greatest, is the greatest shooter in the history of the NBA, period. It's so plain.
That gap, that significant gap, kind of reminds me of the, you know, that your statistical analysis of Dennis Rodman's rebounds, right? Like the difference between him and then the next person is so significant as to just like dwarf like the difference between the two and five guys, right? It's not even close.
Yeah, and I had a hard time with that one. I had a hard time accepting that Dennis Rodman was the greatest rebounder of all time, because there were some other guys that had a lot more bulk totals. But when you got down and started computing it, there were reasons for that. For one thing, Rodman was playing less minutes. He wasn't playing 45 minutes a game like Chamberlain and Russell. He was playing 32. So that's a big difference. You're going to get a lot less rebounds playing, you know, only two-thirds as many minutes. Besides which, the Detroit team played a really slow game pace. And partly attributable to Rodman's defense. He could shut people down. Some of the Detroit game were pretty boring, unless you were a Detroit fan. They had a great team, but boy, they had a boring style of play. They just ground you to death, boring. But Rodman, his rebounding, for that reason, his bulk total was not nearly as great as his impact. His number of rebounds per opportunities was number one of all time. And he was the only player in the NBA ever to average more than 20%. He got more than 20% of the available rebounds. Now, that's a simple thing. It's average guy is going to be 10%. So that's more than twice. It's more than double the average. You know, it's 10 players on the floor at the same time. So 10% is going to be the standard for the average player. Well, Rodman was the only player in the history of the league to average more than 20%. And he got it up to 23%. Now that is, you know, that is really high. That's like 20% higher than the number two guy, because the difference between 23 and 19 is not 4%, it's 20%. It's down to figure it out. You know, you take 4 divided by 20 or something like that.
Right.
So that was, you know, that was the most amazing thing that I just couldn't believe it. And then it turns out it wasn't even close. It wasn't perhaps as big a difference as the Curry thing, but it was close to it. It was about the same. It was about 20%. I'll tell you, that one got me. I
appreciate that. I mean, you saying that, because in the book you do talk about, you know, kind of like your own perception of things versus then when you ran the numbers, sometimes your eye didn't jibe with the number said. That this was one of those cases where you're like, man, I wouldn't have guessed this. And it's the same with, like, you know, gauging the draft picks and you know, outdoing the scouts, yeah, but also outdoing Dave Heron. The 10 decks regularly beat Dave Heron, the man.
Yeah, and the scouts, just off the top of my head, 10x did not make me smarter than the scouts. I was not smarter than the scouts, but 10x was. If you run the 10x numbers on these guys, some of them I thought, wow, I didn't think he was that good, or I didn't think he was that bad. But lo and behold, 5 years later, you check him out in the NBA, and yeah, that's right. 10x was right. I was wrong. The scouts were wrong. And that happened so often that I think it was like 70%. The elite draft choices, you know, like the Hardens and Currys and the Jordans and LeBron James, guys like that, elite guys, Russell, Chamberlain, Robertson. These guys, when you ran the 10x numbers, 10x was almost always right. For instance, Jordan, the scouts put him number 3. Of course, we can look back and say how dumb they were, but you know, that's afterthought. But 10x had Jordan number 1. And one of the reasons 10x had Jordan number 1 was his rate of improvement while he was in college. He was just really improving fast. He didn't jump into basketball like Robertson did, superstar right off the bat. Jordan got better and better and better and better and better. And by the time he got to the NBA, he was still improving for his first couple of years in the NBA. If you look at his record in the NBA, 10x, he was improving, I would say, probably the first 3 or 4 years in the NBA. And his prime years were before they won their titles, which just shows you, well, it wasn't all Jordan. You have to have teammates. It's good to have a Scottie Pippen. It's good to have a Dennis Rodman and a Tony Kukoc. I mean, you got to have teammates to win. But it is fantastic when you just watch it develop that way. And you see 10x is right, and I'm wrong. It happens so often.
Well, there's lots to love if you're a hoops fan, if you're a statistical analysis fan. The book is called 75. It's out through Erlang Print and Media. Dave, thanks very much for coming on and talking about the book, and I really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.